They are one of the largest recipients of NIH funding. Their scientists played a substantial role in developing more than half the cancer drugs approved by the FDA in the last 5 years. Dana-Farber Cancer Institute has been making one advanced cancer discovery after another for over 75 years. At Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, what we do here changes lives everywhere. Find out more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy, and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
To the surprise of absolutely nobody, the Obama administration said today that, why, yes, it would like to keep using the TARP money. An extra couple of $100 billion always does come in handy. Question is, what are they going to do with it? That and special coverage from the climate conference in Copenhagen, Denmark, on the broadcast today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Meritas, a worldwide alliance of law firms helping business owners and in-house counsel find pre-qualified local legal counsel for over 19 years. Meritas.org. And by Bank of America, 1 year into a 10-year, $1.5 trillion investment in low to moderate income communities.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Good to have you here on this Wednesday, everybody. It is the 9th of December. The Obama administration got a little boost from a congressional oversight panel today. In its year-end audit of the bank bailout, more commonly known as TARP, the panel said that despite its flaws, TARP did what it was supposed to do, nip an economic panic in the bud. The timing really could not have been better for Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner. He announced today that he is going to extend TARP through next October. The secretary said he needs the money that hasn't been spent so far, as much as $200 billion, in case financial conditions, quote, threaten our economy. To which I say, what, maybe he knows something we don't? Here's our New York Bureau Chief, Amy Scott.
The bailout fund was set to expire at the end of this month. Lewis Crandall is chief economist with Wrights and ICAP, a research firm. He says letting the program expire would have been like taking away the safety net before you've reached the end of the tightrope.
We still face very serious problems in the commercial real estate sector. And if some of those led to a severe strain on an institution, it's not inconceivable that we would need to stabilize that institution.
Today, Secretary Geithner said any new spending would boost small business and consumer lending and prevent foreclosures. But critics say Democrats want to use the program as a piggy bank. Alex Pollack is a fellow with the conservative American Enterprise Institute.
If you have a pot of money there, there's a temptation to want to spend it. But the pot of money isn't authorized just to be spent.
Republicans have pushed to let the fund expire and use the leftover money to defray the deficit. Some Democrats in Congress want to use unspent TARP money to create jobs. Michael Ettlinger is with the left-leaning Center for American Progress. He says when the program was created, financial stability was the big concern.
Now the problem is much more the lack of jobs. And so moving the resources to address that makes a lot of sense.
Ettlinger says Treasury can use the money to indirectly stimulate job growth by supporting lending. He says Congress would have to approve direct spending to create jobs. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
It looks like the health care overhaul has cleared another hurdle. That only leaves about a zillion or so hurdles to go. This one is a big one, though. Senate Democrats have tentatively agreed to scrap the idea of a government-run insurance plan, a.k.a. the public option. In its place, the uninsured could buy coverage from a network of nonprofits, and people as young as 55 would be allowed to buy into Medicare. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Ganza reports.
The Senate compromise relies on the ultimate public option, Medicare, the government-run health care program for the elderly. Uninsured people aged 55 to 64 could enroll in Medicare, paying their own premiums. This would be especially appealing to people considering early retirement and a lifeline for those losing their jobs and health insurance. Jonathan Gruber teaches economics at MIT.
In some sense, it can kind of be like a trial of a public option. You can say, well, look, let's try a true public option for a small slice of people and see what happens.
One irony is that senators seem to be agreeing that it's better to add several million people to an already huge, overburdened government insurance plan than to accept anything with the name public option. For people who choose Medicare, this could be a good deal if they can find a doctor or hospital. Medicare pays a set rate. Providers say it's not enough to cover their costs. Rick Pollack is executive vice president of the American Hospital Association.
On average, they would get paid 91% of the cost of delivering the service. And that's a pretty big gap.
Is that gap big enough to turn hospitals and doctors against the health care overhaul? Dr. Lori Heim is president of the American Academy of Family Physicians. She's hedging her bets.
We will have to evaluate what are the details of it. Does it provide for a stable funding stream?
Heim says she does support the House health care bill. It does not include the Medicare compromise. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Traders took a rather leisurely stroll down Wall Street today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Everybody who's anybody in the world of sustainability is in Copenhagen this week for that big UN conference on climate change. And so are we. Marketplace's Sam Eaton and Stephen Beard won all-expenses-paid trips to the Danish capital to cover the global economics of global warming. The conference news of this Wednesday comes to us via the South Pacific and the island nation of Tuvalu, population 10,000. Tuvalu wants any deal that may get done at that meeting to be binding. That is not a position its more populous developing economy colleagues in China and India support. And so it could split one of the most powerful groups at that summit right down the middle. Stephen Beard has more now from Copenhagen.
Tuvalu became the darling of environmental activists at the summit because of the stand it took today. The tiny island state is a member of the G77 group of developing nations. By insisting on a legally binding agreement, it defied the group's much bigger, wealthier members, like China and India. Taukie Katala is one of the delegates from Tuvalu. He says his country lies barely 9 feet above sea level, and a big cut in heat-trapping gases is vital.
We have no options if our sea level rises. We have nowhere else to go except underwater. It is a threat to our very existence.
China and India are thought to have opposed Tuvalu for economic reasons. They apparently fear that tougher, legally binding emission curbs might restrain their own growth. But Tuvalu's heroic stand just could backfire. Mark Nichols of Environmental Finance magazine says it could dilute any eventual agreement in Copenhagen.
Potentially, it could make an outcome much more difficult if it sees major developing countries splitting away from some of their poorer peers.
He says the US and Europe could now resist some of the developing world's more onerous demands for deeper emission cuts in the rich countries and more financial help. In Copenhagen, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
If you had to pick one person in this country most closely associated with the fight against global warming, Al Gore is probably going to come to mind. Ever since An Inconvenient Truth came out, he has painted a fairly scary picture of what could happen to our planet if we don't do more to control climate change and do it more quickly. His latest book, Our Choice, is what you might call an instruction manual to fight global warming. He will be in Copenhagen next week, and he says he is confident the delegates will come to an agreement. Mr. Gore, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good to be on Marketplace.
You know, one of the things you pick up on in this book, and that you mention quite a bit, is this idea of efficiency, that there are large gains to be made if we just, you know, seal our windows and be smart about how we use energy. Is it true that anything we do has to be cheap and easy for it to take effect?
Well, sometimes it does seem that way, but it's actually a happy coincidence that so many of the things that are needed to solve the climate crisis do actually end up saving us money. It doesn't mean that they're all easy. Some of them are, like changing the light bulbs. But changing the windows, which saves even more money, is not easy. It takes a decision. These are, taken together, solutions that require us to think about it ahead of time and make a conscious choice to save money while we're saving the planet.
You know, I've been trying to think of a metaphor for the whole discussion of climate change and why it's so hard. And the one I've come up with is this, and bear with me for a second. Remember when your kids were young and they were acting up and they were misbehaving and you kept saying, you guys, cut it out. I really mean it this time. Cut it out. That seems to me to be where we are with climate change, that you have to keep saying these things and yet nobody ever listens.
Well, it's an interesting analogy, but the stakes are so high. If your kid's playing with an electric plug, you use a different tone of voice, and whatever strategy you use, you make sure it succeeds. We're putting 90 million tons of global warming pollution into the atmosphere every day, and the accumulations have now reached levels that are unprecedented, going back as far as they can measure in the ice records and most of the other records. So we really have to make a conscious choice to solve this problem.
You spend some time in your book talking about the political issues about global warming and climate change and some of the problems. Let me see if I can turn that on its head for a second, though, and ask you to address the economic issues. When this meeting at Copenhagen gets down to it, and the richer countries are told by the developing countries, hey, now, you had your run, we want our run. Do you think it's possible for rich countries to just pay these poorer countries to fight climate change and say, listen, we understand, here's some money, help us with the problem?
Well, the disparity in the levels of income between countries like the United States compared to many of these low-income, poor countries is so great that, of course, there will be an international fund established to help these poor countries with the adjustments they won't be able to make. The argument will be over the size of that fund. But the other thing that's changed the way the world looks at that particular dispute is that a lot of these poor countries have come to grips with the impacts that global warming are beginning to have on them. I was in Egypt a few weeks ago, and they're just now recognizing that almost half their agriculture is in the Nile Delta, less than 1 meter above the level of the Mediterranean Sea. These developing countries are discovering fresh and urgent reasons why they need to work with the rest of the world to get a comprehensive global solution, because they've got so much at stake.
Kind of speaks to the denial of the whole thing, right? The Egyptians just now realizing that the Nile Delta is a meter above sea level?
Well, the old cliche, denial ain't just a river in Egypt, is not fully complete. It is also a river in Egypt.
You'd think I set you up for that one, wouldn't you?
Well, it could be.
Listen, on the theory that there is a limit to the public purse for even spending on this issue, is there room for the private sector to step in? As a guy who I imagine invests in green technology and you know is conversant in these kinds of things, what do you think has to come out of Copenhagen that's going to make this viable as an investment and as an economic opportunity?
Well, that's not my principal business, but I have made some investments and I want to be a part of the change that I want to see in the world, to quote a famous man. But a recognition of the artificial subsidies that are now going to the burning of coal and oil is really the single most important thing. And putting a price on CO2 emissions is the way to introduce a level of reality into the measuring of the choices that we make. We're pretending now that it's perfectly okay to dump 90 million tons of this stuff into the thin shell of atmosphere around our planet every single day, as if it's an open sewer. And it's not okay. And the sooner we recognize the reality of the situation and start having rules of the road that let investors and business people and everybody get a clearer picture of the real value of the choices we're making, the better it's going to be for our economy, the better it's going to be for our children.
Quantify this for me for a second, would you? On the scale of railroads and computers, what kind of economic transformation are we looking at here with a low-carbon, green energy, save-the-planet economy?
Think about what happened after the Internet was introduced to the world of personal computers and personal digital assistants and now iPhones. And in the same way, the development of these smart grids with much more efficient energy generation, storage, transmission, distribution, and consumption will trigger a giant global marketplace. We're moving to what they call a widely distributed model, meaning, of course, that instead of relying on large central station 1,000-megawatt generating plants, people are going to have rooftop photovoltaic cells and smart batteries and all kinds of devices. Some of them, again, haven't even been invented yet, but there's going to be a giant new family of industries coming out of this transition to a low-carbon economy.
Al Gore, his most recent book is called Our Choice, A Plan to Solve the Climate Crisis. Mr. Gore, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you very much, Kai.
Commentator David Frum has been thinking a lot about climate change, what can be proved and what has to be inferred, and about how all that might affect the decisions that are being made in Copenhagen and in Washington.
We know how carbon dioxide interacts with heat radiation. We know how much carbon dioxide is being added to the atmosphere every year. And we have a fair estimate of how much more will be added over the next decade if nothing changes. The trouble is, we don't know the things we most want to know. How much will additional increments of carbon raise the planet's surface temperature? How dangerous are such changes? What value should we set on preventing them? Because we don't know the most important things, our climate policy is necessarily based on projections. We are trying to measure risk and the value of mitigating risk. In other words, climate policy is a little like buying insurance. You'd never spend your entire income on a life insurance policy. On the other hand, it would be reckless to go uncovered against large and possibly lethal risks. That's the approach we should be taking with carbon dioxide. We want to put a price on carbon dioxide that encourages consumers to conserve and producers to substitute. The cap-and-trade plan before Congress does not set prices. It sets a limit on the total amount of carbon to be emitted. Such a system creates complex and often perverse incentives, as the Europeans are discovering. In order to win political approval, they set the emissions cap so high that no carbon abatement is expected for years to come. A carbon tax, by contrast, would instantly signal everyone to change their behavior. A tax of, say, $15 per ton would add 14 cents to a gallon of gasoline and raise an estimated $80 billion a year. And it would launch a shift that could be accelerated by higher taxes if the first round did not work fast enough. And unlike a cap-and-trade system, which creates property rights, a tax is very easy to reduce or repeal if further research shows that global warming is proceeding slower or is less harmful than governments today fear. A good insurance agent thinks not only of the policy he or she wants to sell, but about the total needs of the insured. Let's have more of that kind of thinking and less hustle.
David Frum is a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Hustle on over to our website and share your thoughts about climate change or anything else you hear on the broadcast. And while you're there, you can hear the rest of our climate coverage and go behind the scenes at the Copenhagen Conference. Sam Eaton's blogging about it for us. Our website is marketplace.org. Coming up, controlling sprawl with county cash.
How would you feel if you go home and tell your family you lost your job, but that the farmer down the road who owns so many hundred acres is going to get so many dollars so that he'll not sell to somebody to build a house?
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials rose 51 points today. That's a 0.5%, finished at 10,377. The NASDAQ added 10 points, a 0.5%, closed at 2183. The S&P 500 gained 4 points, about a 0.3%, ended things at 1,095. Analyst upgrades of two big companies helped move the markets today. 3M posted a 3.4% gain. Sprint Nextel dialed up 5.6%. Pharmaceuticals gotten the shot in the arm today from analysts. Pfizer rose 2.7%. Merck was up 2.2%. The NASDAQ gains were led by Apple and Research in Motion, which both climbed more than 4%. Today, smartphone maker Research in Motion, that would be the BlackBerry, is expected to benefit from a deal to distribute those BlackBerries in China. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.43%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build strong customer relationships with email marketing and online surveys. ConstantContact.com. By Bank of America, 1 year into a 10-year, $1.5 trillion investment in low to moderate income communities. And is distributed by American Public Media. For information about underwriting this or other APM programs, such as Marketplace Money, visit AmericanPublicMedia.org. Why is a derivative like a Thanksgiving turkey? Visit the Marketplace Whiteboard to find out. Our videos demystify the worlds of finance and economics. Just go to our website, marketplace.org. Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. The Commerce Department reports on international trade for the month of October. Creating jobs is the focus on Capitol Hill. The Joint Economic Committee talks about it in a hearing tomorrow. And events at the United Nations headquarters in New York mark Human Rights Day. This year's theme, non-discrimination. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. 10 years after the merger of AOL and Time Warner made synergy a dirty word, the two are finally going their separate ways. AOL spins off as a separate company today. Its stock starts trading tomorrow. AOL was there at the beginning of the internet frenzy, or close to it anyway. Therein lies the problem, really, because AOL just doesn't seem all that relevant in today's tweeting, Facebooking, Googling world. So, how to get back on the radar? That's where Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith begins.
When AOL and Time Warner decided to merge, the combined companies were worth $350 billion. Today, AOL is worth about $2.5 billion. Rob Enderle is a tech analyst with the Enderle Group.
For some reason, when we talk about AOL, I remember that scene out of the Monty Python and the Holy Grail movie where they're bringing out the dead.
Bring out the dead!
Here's one.
I'm not dead!
Yeah. He says he's not dead.
Yes, he is.
I'm not.
An awful lot of folks have pronounced the company dead, and it begs to differ. But eventually, if they don't get something right, somebody's going to pound it over the head and toss it in the pile.
To breathe new life into its brand, AOL will create more original content and give advertisers a big say. That content will be used to drive readers to AOL's many niche sites like MoviePhone and Engadget, where there are opportunities for more advertising. AOL Chief of Staff Maureen Sullivan.
We have great sites that are aimed at kind of niche enthusiasts, and we know that's how we're going to build new audiences and find the right audiences for our advertisers as well.
AOL still has about 100 million users, more than Facebook and Amazon. But can AOL make this patchwork of niche sites into a rival of Yahoo or Google? Again, tech analyst Rob Enderle.
Could it work? Yeah. This is probably going to be one of the more difficult paths they could take, however.
Difficult because the effort is so high profile, there's not a lot of room for mistakes before everyone starts pronouncing the new AOL dead. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Given the current state of the American real estate industry, suburban sprawl isn't really a phrase in wide circulation anymore. Gone, for now anyway, are the days of farmland being bulldozed to make way for shopping malls or housing complexes. Kent County, Michigan is in no mood to see those days come back. It is considering using public money to keep the sprawl in check. From Michigan Radio, Dustin Dwyer has more.
Back in the boom days of the housing market, many farmers got used to regular visits from developers.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Absolutely. The developers were out there beating the bush daily.
Dennis Heffron owns 700 acres in Kent County, Michigan. Farming is a nearly $200 million industry here, but the county is also home to Michigan's second largest city, Grand Rapids. More and more, the city's population of nearly 200,000 people has been trickling into the countryside. Heffron says he's turned down offers as high as $4.2 million for his land. He says farming is his life. He now heads up Kent County's Agricultural Preservation Board. But many others apparently didn't have the same commitment to farming. From 1997 to 2007, the county lost more than 27,000 acres of farmland to development, a loss of 14%.
Agriculture cannot compete with development when it comes to price of land.
Well, at least that was the case when the county launched its farmland preservation program 7 years ago. It set out to keep farms from becoming subdivisions and strip malls by paying farmers not to sell. The preservation program, in effect, buys the legal right to develop the property. For now, the money mostly comes from private foundations with some matching state and federal dollars. But that money hasn't been enough. The county's goal was to preserve 25,000 acres. So far, the total is just over 750, even though there's a waiting list of farmers to participate. So now, Kent County's elected Board of Commissioners is looking at spending local taxpayer money for the first time to fund the program. But some are questioning the need. The housing boom's over.
I wish you could find some people who want to build houses. If there was a market for people to own new homes, the pressure isn't there.
Commissioner Harold Voorhees opposes using taxpayer money for the farmland preservation program. He lives in a rural area himself, and he says he supports farmers. But he says it's not the right time to go to taxpayers for help. Kent County, like most in Michigan, is facing a huge budget deficit. There are plans to lay off more than 140 county workers, about 8% of the workforce.
How would you feel if you go home and tell your wife and your family you lost your job, but then you read that the farmer down the road who owns so many hundred acres is going to get so many dollars so that he'll not sell to somebody to build a house? Not good policy.
Still, despite the tough times in Kent County and many other parts of the country, farmland preservation remains popular. Bob Wagner is with American Farmland Trust, a national farm preservation group. He says lots of farmers across the country want to sign up.
Most of the statewide programs are seeing no downturn in the interest. There has been a backlog in every major program across the country.
That's even though the money offered has dropped in many areas, along with housing prices. The flip side of that, of course, is that it's cheaper than it used to be to preserve farmland. Dennis Heffron says a recession may even be the best time to do it.
It's really an opportunity now because we're able to buy it for the development rights for much less money.
And even though the pressure from developers has pretty much disappeared, those involved in conservation say they've seen downturns before. And the push for new office parks, houses, and shopping centers always bounces back once the economy improves. In Grand Rapids, Michigan, I'm Dustin Dwyer for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Palm Wonderful, 100% pomegranate juice in the curvy bottle, the antioxidant superpower. Information at pomwonderful.com. And by Putnam Investments, offering total return strategies designed to match your goals. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note this afternoon from the Marketplace desk of, come on, do they not have anything better to do with their time? Congress is really upset about college football's bowl system. Well, maybe not all members of Congress, just a majority of the members on a subcommittee of the House Energy and Commerce Committee. They voted today to ban any Division I postseason bowl game as being promoted as a national championship game unless it's the result of a playoff. No real marketplace angle for you there. I just thought that was interesting. For what it's worth, though, the president has said he doesn't much care for the way things are done now either. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media this Wednesday afternoon. Today, the Dow gained 51 points, 0.5%, finished at 10,337. The NASDAQ added 10 points, 0.5%, 2,183 at the bell. The S&P 500 ticked up 4 points, 0.3%, ended things at 1,095. Mahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Andrea Jackson-Gewirtz, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the program for us. Get all the early business and economic news tomorrow on the Marketplace Morning Report. And coming up next time on this radio broadcast, recessions and restaurants.
Can you believe that? Duck confit, pork belly, two different kinds of sausages, and some great white beans for $14. You cannot beat that.
Yeah, but confit, really? I don't know. I'm Kai Rizdahl. I hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.